Indulge in holiday cravings with the nutrition you need from Ka'Chava's All-in-One Whole Body Shake. It's 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Savor the season knowing you're getting the good stuff your body craves. With Ka'Chava, you're getting the highest quality ingredients. No fillers, no nonsense. Holiday nutrition has never been this easy or delicious. Go to Ka'Chava, K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, and use code NEWS for 15% off.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life, a life savings company for your journey to and through retirement.
With me this morning is Louisa Riley, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Fingal West, Malcolm Byrne, Fianna Fáil TD for the Wicklow-Wexford constituency and chair of the Oireachtas Committee on Artificial Intelligence, and Brian Dobson, formerly of Morning Ireland, formerly of the 6-1 News. And as we were saying just before we came on air, for Brian, it's a unique opportunity to unburden yourself of all of these opinions.
Well, we'll see. Keep listening. You never know.
Where we will start, though, is the Mail has splashed with Martin's top advisor told of Gavin Rent before Fianna Fáil vote. And it says in the subhead then, the chambers also learned by text the day before the party selected the candidate. Now, what this is, in essence, is Jim Gavin, who had the debate that led to the debacle, the debate being an argument with a tenant over unpaid, or rather unreturned monies that Jim Gavin was due to give back. And it led ultimately to him resigning his candidacy for the presidency in one of the more embarrassing electoral disasters from a Fianna Fáil perspective. Malcolm Byrne, what this now says is Jack Chambers and effectively Micheál Martin knew there was a problem.
Well, I'm not going to preempt the publication of the report, which we're expecting to see this week. And I anticipate within that we will get a full account of everything that happened, who knew what and when. And then the other side will obviously be recommendations around the future selection of candidates. I have full confidence in the team. They're a very experienced team who went to carry out this report. And I know that they've conducted quite a lot of interviews. The draft report has been given to Jim Gavin's solicitors, even though he wasn't interviewed by the team. I think it's only right that he gets a chance to look at it before it is
published. It's a Hamlet without the prince, isn't it?
Well, a little bit, but obviously we can't force him to take part.
So he was asked and declined.
Yeah, I would rather obviously be talking about Hamnet, as you mentioned, Paul Mescal and Jesse Buckley here this morning. And I think, you know, that's a phenomenal success for Ireland. But on this report, look, it's due to be published this week. There will be consequences.
Well, what have the consequences been if the report upholds, well, as it is very likely to do given the nature of the reporting in the Mail today, if the report upholds the allegation that Jack Chambers and that the minister through one of his most senior, or rather the leader through one of his most senior advisors were privy to the fact that there was a problem relating to a tenancy with Jim Gavin, what then?
Well, I think it will be a serious issue. As I said, I haven't seen the report or any drafts. But if what transpires is that Fionnuala Sheehan made certain information available, and look, Fionnuala Sheehan is an experienced journalist. If you get a query from Fionnuala, it's not like, you know, a cub reporter on the parish newsletter. It needs to be taken seriously. We were assured that due diligence was done on Jim Gavin. So there are obviously questions that will have to be asked about who knew what, where and when. We will see that this week. And I think until I get a chance to read the report, I'm not going to speculate on that. There's obviously the story in today's Mail on Sunday. We'll see how true it is during the week. But there's been obviously lots of speculation as to what's in the actual report without any of us seeing it.
There's also been a lot of column inches dedicated to just how aggrieved the parliamentary and broader party feel. Are they accurate?
That's true to say. Now, it's not that the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party and the rest of the organisation spent all our time just talking about this issue. In fact, this week, our parliamentary party meeting, we had over 2 hours talking about disability services and assessment of need. Certainly in the immediate aftermath of when Jim Gavin stepped back, there was a lot of hurt and disappointment and indeed anger within the organisation more generally. And certainly for those of us who are members of the parliamentary party where certain assurances were given in terms of due diligence being done, we did feel aggrieved.
What were the assurances?
Well, the question was kind of asked, look, on face value, Jim Gavin was a very good candidate, you know, somebody who had obviously led the Dubs to sporting success, but had a career in the Defence Forces, was somebody who...
But that's all the public domain stuff. What were the assurances given in terms of the due diligence?
That in terms of that the candidate was checked out, so to speak, that there were no skeletons, because I think everybody knows... The presidential election is perhaps the most grueling, and you know every utterance of presidential candidates is examined in detail. You know, on face value, and I have to say, I met Jim Gavin. He impressed me as an individual. I asked, "Look, has there been a full examination done?" I was told that yes, this is the case. So I was prepared to back him on that basis. Had I known, and I've said this before, had I known that some of the questions that were subsequently raised, had I known about that in advance of the parliamentary party meeting, that may have coloured my judgment, and indeed that of other colleagues. But we could only act on the basis of you know what we were assured at the time. I think though for...
But that's to suggest then that if the report comes out and verifies what the Mail on Sunday is saying, then you have a situation where effectively you were lied to by your own party.
Well, no, I wouldn't use the word lied to, but I certainly
feel that...
Well,
if they say we've checked it out and there's no issue, yeah, when they know there's an issue, what else do you call it?
I certainly feel that perhaps sufficient levels of examination of the record weren't done, and certainly there is a concern around what Fionnuala Sheehan raised. I do think, I mean, the report has to come out this week. We need to draw a line under this. You know, there are a lot more serious issues around housing and infrastructure and disability services that we need to address. And actually, that is what we're mostly talking about, because when it comes to the next election in 4 years' time, the presidential election will be a footnote in history. People won't be talking about it, but they will be talking about those issues like housing and infrastructure and disability.
This brings us to the question, who's going to lead the Fianna Fáil party into the next election? Because the clear implications being made by the Mail on Sunday is that Micheál Martin is severely damaged. Now, I'm not sure that Micheál Martin would agree with that view, but they have a breakdown of who is most popular and Jim O'Callaghan by a country mile, 36%. Ahead, or rather 36%, with the next nearest challenger on 20% to Jack Chambers. Do you think Micheál Martin has been that undermined by this?
Well, I think, Anton, if John Lee's report in the Mail on Sunday today is correct, I think this is a big problem for Micheál Martin. Mm-hmm. Because you've got to look at the sequence here. Fionnuala makes this call to the Fianna Fáil press office on the 5th of September, says there are concerns or issues have been raised around possible unrefunded rent by Jim Gavin. That then, according to John's report, is escalated to Deirdre Galán, who is the Taoiseach's, Micheál Martin's chief of staff. She's been with him for many years. If you tell Deirdre Galán, you tell the Taoiseach. So Micheál Martin, on the basis of that evidence today, would have been aware of this situation. Now, in what sort of detail, who knows? Again, that's the sort of information that presumably will come out during the report. But at the parliamentary party meeting the following Tuesday, Micheál Martin oversaw the selection of Jim Gavin as the candidate.
The railroading, as many would characterise it.
Well, that's certainly the way it's been characterised by some members of the Fianna Fáil parliamentary party. And I think, as you said there, the issue here is, where does this leave Micheál Martin's leadership? Now, John is saying that calls on Micheál Martin to stand down are likely to intensify when the depth and scope of this was handling of this presidential campaign issue are made public. They quote senior Fianna Fáil figures, unnamed, saying the contents of the report is almost certain, quote, to lead to a motion of no confidence against Mr. Martin. So I think it is very serious. There are certainly more serious issues in our public life at the moment, as Malcolm said, that people want to see tackled. But if this significantly and seriously undermines Micheál Martin's leadership and maybe leads to, ultimately to his departure as leader of the party, then I think the presidential campaign will be a lot more than a footnote in Irish history.
The timing, it has to be said, is probably uncoincidentally fortuitous. If the report comes out on Wednesday, Louise, the main focus of most people, and I suspect most politicians, will have shifted to mince pies, mulled wine and prezzies.
Oh, and no doubt that forms a large part of the thinking. You know, I mean, a series of broken promises and a renter getting screwed over. Like, could you have a more Fianna Fáil style scandal? I don't think so. I mean, at the end of the day, if, as Brian says, if what John Lee is writing in the paper is a true reflection of the sequence of events, and that is borne out in the report that they have done everything to avoid publishing for whatever reason. There's no interest in accountability, of course, at any level in the party, it would seem. But if it is the case that that's an accurate reflection of what is in the report, then of course that's going to be a serious issue for the leadership of Fianna Fáil. But, you know, it's a matter for Fianna Fáil who leads Fianna Fáil. That is entirely their business. You know,
there's an awful lot of nuance potentially in it, though, isn't there? Because it depends on when we say Deirdre Galland might have known or Jack Chambers might have known the teaching. The issue is might have known what precisely, because if the information was, well, there was a tenant dispute 15 years ago, but it's as long
well,
as
might
it's
have
over.
Known enough to maybe ask a few questions, Anton, to get the information. Might have known enough to maybe lift their hands from their eyes and actually look at the situation. I mean, look, it wasn't known to me, by the way, right? But apparently, according to the renter, who I'm sure we've all listened to the podcast, he had made it known. It was not a secret. So it's not like they'd have to hire a private investigator. Perhaps just asking a few very simple questions would have got them the information that turned out, had they had it, might have borne out a very different result. You know, I mean, obviously we backed Catherine Connolly in the election campaign. It was, and I said this in the studio with you the week afterwards, because you had questioned a couple of weeks before whether or not it was a game changer. It was. She went from fourth place to first. She won. She didn't just win. She won by a mile. And I think she's proving herself to be a very, very a good president. And she's doing exactly what she said, which is she's bringing the Oris out and she's out. I follow her on social media. I see that she's out doing, President Connolly is out doing a lot of visits and really engaging with people. I think she's making a very good president. But what's going on in Fianna Fáil at the moment is, you know, a bit of a distraction. And Malcolm said they spent 2 hours talking about disability and assessment of need at their parliamentary party meeting. Of course they did, because there were disability campaigners outside and Cara Darmody was on campaigning against the €1,400 cut that they have experienced in the budget, that people with disabilities. Okay. And Cara Darmody was on a 50-hour protest because of the shambles of assessment of need.
Okay, one final thing on the issue in respect to Jim Gavin, then we move on. The Sunday Times, the front page, Malcolm Byrne reporting that whatever about reputational damage, whatever about the impact on Micheál Martin, €400,000 out the window.
Well, yeah, look, it was an expensive campaign. There's no doubt about that. And I think everyone within the party has acknowledged you know, that it was an embarrassment, and this is something that's going to have to be addressed in the report this week.
You wanted to discuss, as you put it, there were more significant issues nationally than the internal machinations of the Fianna Fáil party. One of those on the front page of the Business Post this morning: state developer to tap lender for €1 billion in first debt deal. This is the Land Development Agency, which is going to be able to borrow €1 billion from the European Investment Bank to try to ramp up the delivery of new homes. Now, on the back of a fag packet, if you do the maths, €1 billion in terms of actual numbers of homes delivered, it is a drop in the ocean of the quantum that's required, isn't it?
Absolutely. But I think the point in Killian Wood's story is around how the Land Development Agency, and the expectation is that by 2028, it could be the largest developer of homes in the state, but that this billion could deliver at least 2,500 new homes. Delivery of housing is the top priority for government. It's around how we can build more social housing, more affordable housing, and just more homes generally. And we've got to try every mechanism to do that.
Positively disposed to, because the Sinn Féin housing policy has long supported government intervention in the market. This at least is a step in the right direction, is it?
In order to do that, I think what we need to see the government doing is concentrating on affordability, and they don't. I mean, an affordable house in my constituency sells for over €500,000. I don't know who exactly that is affordable to, other than people who, you know.
But there is still a demand beyond the capacity to supply at that price range. There are still people queuing up to buy them.
But there are people, that's desperation. And that's people who are buying at a much, much older age than would previously have been the case. You know, I mean,
is it nonetheless not a good thing that you have the LDA starting to produce homes from state access capital and facilitating, or at least supporting or competing with?
There are other ways to do it, okay, but we do want to see the government investing in truly affordable homes. But the cost of housing in this state has risen at a phenomenal rate. It is now beyond the reach of the vast majority of ordinary people. And, you know, not alone that, but renting is also beyond the reach of people on ordinary incomes. And hence you come back to...
But does supply,
you know,
not help with those problems?
Of course, supply will help, but it has to be a supply of affordable homes. And the problem that we have is that the homes are not affordable. The tax breaks are going to big investors and developers. They're getting the benefit. Ordinary people got absolutely nothing in the budget. In fact, many of them will be worse off as a result of the budget. And housing is getting even further away from them. And, you know, I mean...
Maybe I'm I'm naive here, but I would have thought if what you have is a need of 30 or 50,000 homes per annum, anything that starts to increase production has to, by just the law of supply and demand, gradually start to contribute to the reduction of cost, does it not?
But there is a supply problem, but there is also an affordability problem. And this is what I'm saying. If the supply issue is not addressed from the perspective of affordability, then what we will simply do is create more and more homes that will be snapped up by developers that will then be rented back to people. And that's not good. It doesn't give people a foundation. People want to be able to buy a home. They want to be able to buy a home near where they work. They want to be able to buy a home near where their family and their community is. And that's getting further and further away. That links into a topic I know we're going to be discussing later if we get to it, in relation to working from home, hybrid and remote working. Again, a lot of people have to live very far away from where they work simply because they cannot afford to live near their own communities. And that's, I mean, that is no way to be able to start your life and start your family.
I mean, I think there's a couple of interesting things about this story in the Business Post, Anton. First of all, it makes very clear, in a way perhaps that people mightn't, I certainly didn't quite understand, the financial challenge of dealing with our housing crisis. Because as you said, the figure is 1 billion that the Land Development Agency has been authorised to borrow. And the number of homes delivered for that would be 2,500, which is not insignificant, but is way, way short of what we need every year to tackle our housing crisis. So that's the scale of the financial challenge we face. Secondly, this...
Sorry to cut across your brain, but just to put the where you say way, way short, as I understand it, the current calculations are that we need something to the tune of about 50,000 homes.
Yeah, the figure has varied. I've heard of 35, 40, 50, 60,000.
So we're in the 10 to 20 times that.
Okay, yeah. So that's the... Now, the Land Development Agency itself, I think, is authorised, according to the piece here, to say spend close on 9 billion euro, and some of that can be borrowed. But that shows us the scale of the challenge we face. So it's not going to be sorted out within the lifetime of this government, or probably the lifetime of the next government. But this government is going to be judged on how it tackles the issue and how it begins to bring some improvement to the challenges that that Louise has been outlining. I think the other interesting aspect of this is that the report makes reference to the fact that the LDA has already been doing deals with private developers, Cairn Homes and Castlethorne, to build cost rental housing, which is the type of housing that addresses exactly these issues that Louise has been outlining in terms of affordable accommodation. And in the case of Castlethorne, I think it's 328 homes in Shankill. In the case of Cairn Homes, it's just over 600 cost rental homes in Seven Mills near Clondalkin.
The numbers are so small by comparison to the problem.
But if you add another 600 to another 600, 2,500 to another 2,500, you do begin to make some dent in dealing with the demand. For years that I've been reporting and listening to this debate about housing, and it goes back a decade or perhaps more, the call has been for much more direct engagement by the state in the provision of homes. And the Land Development Agency seems to me to be a step in that direction. And to that extent, I'm sure it's something that is welcome, that people will begin to see now the state, rather than depending on tax breaks to developers to try and deliver homes and operating that remove, we see at least some direct intervention in the market to try to deliver the housing.
Although I'm sure Owen O'Brien would say it is a tiny step, and a tiny step far too late.
But also, I mean, the housing crisis, and we can use that word, or emergency or disaster, I mean, there's any one of a number of words you can use, and nobody in government would contradict you, is entirely the result of government policy. I mean, this is the outworkings of the government policy. And if you want a measurement of how bad the housing crisis is, I mean, I would invite anyone to come and sit in my clinic with me on a Friday afternoon, and you could see it. But even if you didn't want to do that, you could look at the rising number of families in emergency accommodation. You know, like, there are nearly 6,000 children who will be in emergency accommodation. Some of them will be in emergency accommodation for their second or their third Christmas. There are parents that you speak to who are having to buy toys and kids that are asking Santa for toys that are appropriate to their cramped, overcrowded living conditions. You know, there are children who will not ask Santa for a bike this year simply because they will not be able to use the bike where they are because they are living in a family hub or in emergency accommodation. There are families being accommodated in single person accommodation in Dublin City. So if you want a measure of how badly this government are failing people, that is a very accurate measurement. And that is a figure that has risen consistently, month on month, year on year. Okay. And there are children who will experience their third or their second Christmas in emergency accommodation.
Okay. Malcolm Byrne, very briefly, because we need to take a break.
Yeah, I think if you look at what the LGA is trying to do in terms of providing cost rental, it is about trying to provide homes for many of those who are caught. In terms of social homes, we are seeing them being built. And like Louise, I deal with people who are coming into my clinics regularly. We are now seeing people coming off the housing list. The key questions are about supply. And in order to be able to do that, for builders, we need certainty around cost. So that makes sure we need service land. So that needs about equipping Ishgair and making sure ESB networks, that there can be connections to the grid done very quickly. We do need more builders that are out there. We're talking about some of the large construction companies. We have a shortage of some of those large construction companies. But these are all moves in the right direction in terms of the state trying to provide as many homes. There are other reforms coming.
By 4 years when you have to stand in front of the voters?
It's not going to be solved in 4 years, but there will be significant progress. There's also, as you know, issues being addressed around the Civil Reform Bill to address questions like, you know, judicial reforms. Certain local councillors, including Louise's party, need to stop objecting to the building of homes, and because
when councillors object to state land being gifted to developers,
it's about building homes. If you're homeless, you want a home, and it doesn't matter whether it's coming from the private sector or the local authority.
For a moment, if you are homeless, you know exactly where the blame lies, and you know exactly the policies that have caused that. However, if the state is not building social and affordable homes on state land, well, then it is failing. And if you're expecting Sinn Féin councillors to support the gifting of state land to developers, we will not do that.
Guys, it's only 25
minutes. Stop objecting to homes.
We have another 35 minutes. We can come back to this after the break.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made to last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Before we go to the break, I just want to give you a reminder of the cash machine.
News Talk's Christmas cash machine.
So, cash machine is up to €300,000. Guaranteed winner of €300,000 this Friday. Taking part is easy. We give you an amount, you take a note of it, you enter. And don't forget, there is a new way that you can enter now, which is online. The number you need to know, 300,000 exactly. You can visit newstalk.com/cash machine and enter online. You can text the word play to 57557. That's 57557. The latter will cost you €2.50 plus your standard message rate to play. You have to be over 18. You're playing across the Go Loud network of stations. Full terms on the website, newstalk.com. Get your entry in by 3 p.m. on Friday. The cash machine will randomly pick a number, and it could be you that gets the call during Moncrief. Answer within five rings, tells the prize amount, and the cash is yours. The number again, €300,000 exactly, and you can text play to 57557. We will pick up on the issue of housing again with Malcolm and with Louise after the break. We'll also be finding out from Brian Dobson whether or not he would have been willing to write a 1,000-word essay to get his former job, because that's what his replacement had to do. With me is Malcolm Byrne, Fianna Fáil TD for Wicklow Wexford, and Louise O'Reilly, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Fingal West, and of course Brian Dobson, formerly of RTE. We're going across to the Antipodes now, to Australia, where reports are that around 9 people have been killed, more than a dozen wounded, when gunmen opened fire during a Hanukkah celebration at Sydney's Bondi Beach today. New South Wales police saying that 2 people have been taken into custody, and the Australian Broadcasting Corporation saying at least one of the gunmen is among those killed. And obviously we're at the early stages of reporting, and data is, and details are only just emerging. We have with us Jack Han, who is a news reporter at the Today Show based in Sydney. Jack, the details that we have thus far, I realise there is still information emerging. Can you just give us a confirmation of the casualty numbers, victim numbers, and also details of what happened?
Look, I hate to bring this to you and your audience this morning, but unfortunately the death toll has just risen. Confirmation from local police here that at least 10 people have been killed in this mass shooting on Bondi Beach. We have at least 16 people that are right now in hospital, and it pains me to say that at least one of those patients is at the Sydney Children's Hospital, which would suggest to you and obviously means that a child has been involved in this incident. A mass shooting at Bondi Beach, 6 o'clock in the evening. It was beautiful here. About a 25-degree day. The sun was setting. Bondi Beach, you guys know it well. It's a popular spot around the world, and it was packed with people when all of a sudden, police say, 2 gunmen opened fire with large long-arm rifles. And we live in Australia, you know, much the same way you are. You hear the sound of gunfire, and initially you would confuse it for fireworks or perhaps a car backfiring, and that's what people did. They turned and then they saw this carnage unfolding, people dropping to the ground. And again, I will keep the details appropriate for this time of the morning, but, you know, this is just a terrible situation. We've had these 2 gunmen, then we've got these brave police officers, all right? So we've got 2 general duties officers. I mean, you're on the beat in Bondi Beach. What do you expect to deal with? Not this. They rock up. Unfortunately, it's confirmed that at least one officer has been killed confronting these shooters, another one seriously hurt. So the situation, as I speak to you right now, it's 9:30 here in Sydney. This situation played out by and large about 3 hours ago, and it's still very active here at Bondi Beach. They've had to set up a makeshift hospital here to just stabilize the patients before taking them to hospital. In terms of the backstory to this, police telling us there was this Jewish event nearby. Was it targeted? It's too early to say. However, I can tell you, and again, I'm only bringing you confirmed information. Unfortunately, I can report that improvised explosive devices have been found on Bondi Beach as well. Thankfully, they did not detonate, but a terrible situation unfolding here in Sydney as I join you this morning.
And from what I'm seeing from some of the social media video that is circulating, there appears to be evidence of extraordinary courage and bravery on display from the officers that responded.
Yes, indeed. And I will caution you and your listeners, stuff spreads very quickly around the world. And if you are seeing some of this footage, particularly if you have children on social media, it's probably a good idea to give them a warning, because Bondi Beach, thousands of people there, plenty of phones, and this horrific carnage has been captured. But you are right, a whole lot of bravery from officers as well, and also from general members of the public. I saw a video of this one man who confronted the shooter, tried taking the gun off him, and trying to apprehend the suspect with the gun, and that didn't work, and that bystander thought, right, I'm running away, So look, there's a whole lot of vision at the moment. The situation as it stands, unfortunately, we do have 10 people dead, 16 in hospital. As I mentioned, one child is right now in hospital. We've got a makeshift hospital also set up there at Bondi Beach, and we know that Jewish celebrations across Australia have been cancelled. It is horrific. People have described the scene as a war zone at Bondi Beach this afternoon with this carnage. And I can tell you that the Australian Prime Minister has set up a national security meeting as well. We're seeing a whole bunch of public events being cancelled. And the fear now, it's hard to articulate the fear here in Sydney. There's now been multiple reports around of people going, oh, well, this looks suspicious, this looks suspicious. Oh, I've heard a car backfire, that might be shot.
Well, that was Jack Han there reporting for us. Just the line dropped at the end. Jack Han, news reporter at the Today Show, based in Sydney. Absolutely horrendous attack. And I suppose if there is any solace to be taken from it, it is what Jack was saying there, that explosive devices found which hadn't been detonated on the beach. Malcolm Byrne, you were making the point during the break. There's obviously a strong affinity between Ireland and Australia going back generations. There's a particularly strong affinity with Bondi Beach, huge Irish population in that area.
I mean, this is horrific. You've got to remember that this is the middle of the Australian summer. You know, Bondi Beach, probably the most famous beach in Australia. It's particularly popular with Irish backpackers, you know, Irish tourists. So there are bound to be a significant number of Irish people around. I know it's too early to say, but obviously if it is linked to the Hanukkah celebrations, it's deeply concerning. But I think for an event, something like that, just as the news is breaking, it's horrific. And, you know, our sympathies can only be with the people of Australia. And this is like, you know, for those who don't know Bondi Beach, like it's an incredibly popular tourist destination. Anyone who ever goes to Sydney, you can be guaranteed they'll end up at Bondi.
I don't think there's a family in the state that doesn't know somebody or have a family member living in Australia. There are very close ties. It's absolutely horrendous what's unfolding at the moment. And obviously, you know, sympathies to the Australian people, absolutely, but to the first responders and to the people who were forced on the scene and dealing with the aftermath of it. I think we'll probably learn a lot more about them in the coming days and weeks. But for the moment, it's just very, very shocking.
Well, that point that Jack Han made there, that you're on the beat on Bondi Beach, what do you expect to deal with? You don't expect to deal with two people with assault rifles and explosives.
Oh, no, I'd say you expect to deal with, you know, probably people out enjoying themselves, you know, just crowd control issues is probably more than anything else. But they do appear to have stepped right up to the plate, the first responders, and they have they've responded incredibly well. But it's just a very, very dark and as was said, it's their summertime, 6 o'clock in the evening, families out.
It'll be very shocking for Australians because, you know, this is, I would think, probably the single biggest loss of life in an incident of this sort that the country's ever experienced.
And if it does turn out to be connected, as it appears at first glance, to be linked to Hanukkah celebrations, it will also be devastating and frightening for the Jewish community worldwide, I would have thought.
Well, it's not the first time that members of the Jewish community have been targeted, and that certainly will be a factor if that is the case. But it's a little early perhaps to come to those sort of judgments just yet, I would say.
Well, as we find out more throughout the morning, obviously we will keep you updated. 53106, if you would like to get in touch, that'll cost you 30 cents. Or 087-1400-106. While we are on the topic of security, there's interesting coverage in some of the newspapers this morning in relation to our own national security and how well prepared we are in respect of it. The Sunday Times saying, Taoiseach sets new focus on national security. Martin highlights threat to energy and communications. And Malcolm Byrne, one of the things that is interesting in this is the reports in the Sunday Times, John Mooney, their investigations editor, saying that the Russian ship that was mapping the sea bottom through the Irish Sea, specifically looking at the gas interconnector between the UK and Ireland.
Mm-hmm. So we've had a problem with, and we know that the Russian shadow fleet have been operating in Irish waters for quite some time. And the particular fear is, as you know, there are a number of energy interconnectors between Ireland and Britain and also between Ireland and continental Europe. And then, crucially, a lot of the transatlantic cables on which modern communication depend run through Irish waters. In fact, 95% of data that is transferred between Europe and North America runs through the cables in Irish waters.
Is that correct? 95%?
Yeah, it's 95%. It's the cables that carry, about 95% of them are in Irish waters. So there's obviously concern where you have Russian vessels operating in that space. There are clear concerns that have been outlined by the Defence Forces during President Zelensky's visit about the fact that unidentified drones were operating in Irish airspace at the time. And that comes on top of when there was the meeting of the EU Council in Copenhagen, when the heads of government and heads of state gathered there earlier this year. Again, we saw a number of drones that are being attributed to Russia were also operating. So we do need to take our defence and security seriously. The state and various agencies of the state have experienced quite a number of cyber attacks or efforts at cyber attacks. So, there's been a significant increase in defence spending. That includes, obviously, in terms of improving the terms and conditions of those who are members of the defence forces. But I think what is critical is that we look at investment in that defence infrastructure to deal with the likes of the Russian shadow fleet and potential cyber attacks.
Is there political consensus across the Dáil on this, Louise? Is there a sense within the opposition that a similar sense that spending needs to be increased on our defence?
I think there's definitely very, very clear consensus in relation to funding for our defence forces. They have been absolutely neglected, underfunded for a very, very long time. We know this. We know that because they tell us. We also know that there were deficits identified in the Commission on the Defence Forces. And that's going back. We didn't.
But things like cyber defence, radar defence, all that.
Again,
would you include that?
These were identified as part of the Commission report. So there is a roadmap already there. We didn't need to wait for the unidentified drones and for that issue. This is already an issue. It's something that the defence members of the Defence Forces have been flagging to politicians and particularly fallen on deaf ears with.
But it is a policy move that you would support. I mean, if the government does say, look, we're going to increase spending.
I think we need to be absolutely. We need to ensure that we are spending at the right level. We absolutely do. We also need to ensure that we are making up for those deficits. I mean, when we talk about the water surrounding the island, we need to be clear that at any given day, the Navy ships can't take to sea because they don't have sufficient personnel. So, it's not just about talking about the big issues. It's actually about getting the basics right. And that's where we often see the government falling down.
With me this morning is Louise O'Reilly, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Fingal West, Malcolm Byrne, Fianna Fáil TD for Wicklow Wexford, and Brian Dobson, formerly RTE. Just a reminder, we have a nice prize thanks to the Kingsley Hotel. They're getting ready for the festive season. You can go and soak up the vibrant atmosphere of Cork City with the gorgeous four-star hotel, the Kingsley. Beautiful bedrooms, bistro-style restaurant, a luxury award-winning spa and pet-friendly rooms. The Kingsley has everything you need for the perfect retreat to Cork City. To plan your escape, visit thekingsley.ie. And the prize that we have is a two-night break at the Kingsley. You get to stay in a luxurious room overlooking the River Lee with breakfast each morning and dinner on one evening in the Springboard restaurant. And all you have to do to be in with a chance of winning is text the word Cork and your name to us now on 53106. That's 53106. Text cost 30 cent. After the break, AIB is reportedly doubling down on the end to hybrid working. Further pressure to get people back in the office. As Brian put it during the break, we are heading into the employment section of the programme because we're dealing with matters of employment. The second being AIB acting something, I think to some extent being a stalker course for an awful lot of large companies who would like to follow their lead. This is pressuring people to get back into the office. We'll come to that in a second because the other bit of the employment section of the programme is revelations about how you get significant jobs in RTE and ructions about these, according to the Sunday Independent, which says that people in RTE are aggrieved at the childish task that people were given to get what was once Brian Dobson's job.
Right,
so,
yeah.
Did you have to write a 1,000-word essay to get the job?
No, I didn't. No, that was a different era. But Niamh Horan is reporting that that was part of the process of the recruitment, eventually, of Tommy Mescal, who's going to be the new co-presenter. He replaces David McCullough, who's gone to the radio. So Niamh is reporting that there are several sources in RTE she spoke to were very annoyed at the way the process was carried out. So it involved the, as you say, the writing of this 1,000-word max paper on your vision for the job and your vision for the programme. Actually, there's a statement from RTE, which Niamh quotes. She says, they say, a thorough HR process was held recently for this position in which those interested were asked to submit a cover letter, a CV and a short paper, maximum 1,000 words, outlining their vision for the role. This is standard practice for key editorial and senior roles within the organisation.
Now, Brian, can I be cynical for a moment? So, I would have thought a job like the one that you held for so long and so successfully, one of the advantages in who you put in it is you can see them do their existing job. Everybody in RTE knows there's the suite of candidates. I get to watch them do their jobs. I know how competent they are. They've been on air before. I'll pick the one I know to be the best. How does a 1,000-word essay help this?
And as I said, that was the process when I was recruited. I was plucked, if you like, and given the job. But I think there has been a concern in recent years that the process becomes a bit more transparent and that it opens up opportunities for people.
So does it though, or is it pointless box ticking for no need?
Well, I'm not sure that it is pointless, because it gives people the opportunity to express to the management that this is an area, if that's the area they'd like to go and they'd like to move in that direction. And every other job that's advertised in every other part of RTE and most organisations involves an advertisement, an interview process, and very often there might be some sort of submission, 1,000 words or whatever. 1,000 words to most journalists isn't very much. You know, you can knock it off fairly quickly yourself. I'm wondering, is the article, you know, much more than 1,000 words? So I'm not sure there's really, you know, a whole big issue here. And I noticed there's been no complaint from the National Union of Journalists, so there's nobody on that side saying this is an unfair process.
Well, as you say, it'd be a bit much for a journalist to complain about having to churn out 1,000 words.
I'm sure they could. I'm sure they all were able to manage it.
The other thing, by the way.
And I think at the end of the day, I think they got the right person, if I can say. Yeah, I think Tommy
Meskell is a great journalist.
He's a great reporter. Yeah. He's been working in London as a correspondent there. He's a lot of experience. He started out in RTE on News Today on the children's news programme and was absolutely fantastic. So he's lots of live on air.
Oh, he does. And no doubt he will he will do a good job. He is a good journalist. He's a very accomplished journalist, even at such a young age. I would kind of hesitate around the 1,000-word essay not being necessarily commensurate with the level of the job. But as Brian says, if the NUJ are happy with the process, there has to be a process. You cannot have, you know, it can't be the case that, you know, somebody in a high position in RTE selects the person themselves just for whatever reason. There has to be an open and a transparent process. I don't know about the 1,000-word essay, but for the person that it is, that should cause them absolutely no problem whatsoever.
But is the open and transparent process not sufficient that you say I put in my application? And that's it. I apply for the job. You know the work that I do. It is not a job that is done in secret. If you are a working broadcaster, we see what we get your output every day.
Yeah. Absolutely. But there also does need to be a process, and it has to be transparent. I mean, if we learned nothing, and I know Brian doesn't work there anymore, but if we learned nothing from the scandals in RTE, we learned that they are quite well paid. So, you know, when there are jobs like this going, there should be an open and a transparent process.
I would say one other thing. Sorry, if I was just going to say that the report also, Niamh's piece says, asked if they received feedback on their essays, the source said no. Now, I think that should be the case. You should get feedback.
Yeah, and if you don't get feedback, leave you thinking that it is a bit of an empty exercise.
But maybe that's yet to come.
I think the challenge, though, for RTE, and you know, there's been quite a big shake-up in terms of the presenters on TV and radio. But the challenge for RTE, no different to any other Irish broadcaster, is there's now competition on a global scale. I mean, for me, the big media news story this week was the kind of Paramount and Netflix competing with each other, where you're talking about, you know, 100 billion potential takeover of Warner Brothers and the debates that are happening there, you know, around global media control. And I think it is really important that we continue to have Irish broadcasters, including RTE and Newstalk, where those stories are able to be told. And having faces that we can trust, like Tommy Meskell, at the head of a very important news programme, I think is positive.
Second bit of our employment section, AIB's continuing pressure to try to coax its staff back in on a more permanent basis. And I think the line, I'm paraphrasing slightly, but I think the line that I saw was one that said, if you want a job, you can work hybrid. If you want a career, you need to be in the office. Are we starting to see the steady chipping away on hybrid work? Is it coming to an end?
Well, I think what COVID showed us and the lockdown showed us that actually working from home, remote work and hybrid and remote working can work, and it can be made to work. We have technology now that can facilitate it. People did it. They did it very effectively.
A lot of employers feel otherwise, though, don't they?
I don't believe that that's necessarily the case. If you look at the organisation Grow Remote, for example, they have a lot of new employers joining them. They were in the Oireachtas during the week. New employers joining them all the time. New people who are part of the Grow Remote network, and it's a way to network at local level. I think there was a missed opportunity with remote working in terms of using it as a driver for local business. I also think that, you know, what happened with the legislation that came in, it came in under Leo Varadkar. He started off from a very, 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 very bad place. It was basically a charter for 13 reasons why a boss could tell you can't have remote working. He recognised his mistake eventually after it was pointed out to him several times by me and others. He then withdrew that legislation, and then he wrapped it into another piece of legislation, which was known as the Work-Life Balance Bill, which gave it absolutely no teeth whatsoever.
Oh, yeah, this was you could ask, but you could be told no, effectively.
As I said to him, and I'd say it here again, she always had the right to ask. There is a framework now for the discussion to take place, but there is no right to have your... And I'm not saying that. What I would like to see, though, is a scenario whereby a person can have their application assessed. And if it is, on balance, a 50-50 call, that they will make that call in favour of remote work, and if that's what the worker wants. And we spoke earlier about the housing crisis and the way in which government policy has contributed to make it as bad as it is. We all know that. And there are people who made decisions about where they live on the basis of not being able to afford to live near their work. People can't. They're living further and further out. We know the M50's at capacity. There was people fainting on the train coming in the other morning because it was so overcrowded. So we do need to look at the possibility of remote working and not constantly look at it suspiciously.
Thing, though, of the sort of the sit by Arnelli approach? This sense that you're reading between the lines of what senior employers are saying, that there is a sense that if you want to learn your way up the ranks, presenteeism matters.
Yeah, well, first of all, we shouldn't forget there's lots of people who don't have the option of remote work, and they simply have to go because they're delivering a personal service, or, you know, they need to be there. So that's the first thing to say. I think that actually the point you make, Anton, is really at the heart of this, because I think that particularly for younger people starting out on their careers, coming to experience the workplace, initially, really do benefit from the face-to-face contact. I mean, I just believe that to be the case. I know it from my own experience working in journalism all those years, and I think they lose out badly on that if they're working remotely. And I think if you can find a way to replicate that, but I'm not sure you can by working remotely, then fair enough. But I really do think particularly younger people in the workplace, or people starting out in a job and getting to know the team. I remember being at a Christmas dinner in a restaurant in Dublin during the COVID period, one of those ones where they lifted the restrictions, and there was a group of people who had all come together for a Christmas party, and they were all meeting from the same workplace, and they're all meeting each other for the first time in a year. There are people who've been recruited, never met before. So I do think there needs to be at least some hybrid element to the process.
I think hybrid is what people want, though, Brian. I think people want to know that they'll have their application considered, that there is technology available to facilitate that. And you're dead right. There are plenty of people who could never, ever do any form of remote working. But for the people who can, they should be facilitated with a hybrid model.
They're also remote work hubs, which is, it's not just about the idea of people sitting at their kitchen table. So I know, for instance, Gorey, where I'm from, the Hatch Lab in Gorey, there you have a number of individuals who come, they hot desk, but there they have a network that they have groups of people that they can talk to. So it includes people I know who are like solicitors in Dublin. They can carry out their business. They have other people that they can share the office space with. Okay. So it's about getting the balance right, I think.
A text establishing, I think, a universal truth. The only people that think remote working is a good idea are the people who are remote working. Well, that may be true, but there are several tens of thousands of them in that category.
I think remote working is a good idea, and I don't.
I don't think any politician could remote work somehow.
Louise O'Reilly, Malcolm Byrne, thank you both very much. Malcolm Byrne, Fianna Fáil TD for Wicklow Wexford, Louise O'Reilly, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Fingal West, and thank you very much to Brian Dobson, of course, formerly of RTÉ.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details Because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion. It's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.